The following presentation is brought to you by the Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to Danelle Dadigan, founder of the Hollywood Museum, which is hosting its second annual Reel to Reel, Portrayals and Perceptions of Gays in Hollywood through September 2015. The museum, just steps from the Hollywood Walk of Fame, houses one of the largest collections of entertainment memorabilia in the world. Stick around. When this is over, everybody watching is going to marry somebody, and it's all perfectly legal. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you today by Amazon.com. When you visit MrMedia.com and click on any of the links to purchase books, music, movies, gift certificates, or anything else through our Amazon link, you support this free video podcast. Whenever you need something else from Amazon, please consider returning to MrMedia.com to order it. It doesn't cost you any extra, and we sure appreciate the support. And don't forget, MrMedia.com has more than 1,200 celebrity audio and video interviews archived on the site. That's hundreds upon hundreds of hours free entertainment. Subscribe for free on MrMedia.com, and you'll instantly get an email every time a new interview is posted. You can also watch and subscribe to the show on YouTube, Vimeo, Dailymotion, The Realm Network, and Frequency.com. And if you preferred to just listen, Mr. Media is also available for free on iTunes, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, Podfeed.net, and Player FM. You can subscribe to any of those services and never miss another episode. Finally, you can interact with Mr. Media interviews on all kinds of social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and more. Friend or follow us, we'll friend or follow you back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of lesbians, gays, bisexuals, and transgenders who can't help but smile just a little bit more this week in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. I've been to some great big museums around the world. MoMA in New York, the Centre Georges Pompidou in Paris, the Tate Modern in London, to just name a few. But to be honest, I've always gotten as big a thrill out of smaller, more specialized collections, such as, I don't know, the Sherlock Holmes Museum in London, the Norman Rockwell Museum of Vermont, or the Salvador Dali Museum right here in St. Petersburg. I'm a pop culture guy, and these are the kinds of places where I can get a satisfying fix. So when I heard about the Hollywood Museum, it sounded like the kind of place for me. And if you watch the show, I'm thinking it's right for you, too. Located in the former building of Hollywood fashion icon Max Factor, just steps from the Hollywood Walk of Fame, the Hollywood Museum is packed with artifacts and classic images of the best-known Tinseltown legends, from Judy Garland and Lana Turner to Elizabeth Taylor and Marilyn Monroe. Today, we're going to do the next best thing to visiting the Hollywood Museum. We're going to bring it to us. Joining me is Danelle Dadigan, founder of the museum. She's going to talk about the scope of the facility, highlight some of the exhibits, including the current reel-to-reel, Portrayals and Perceptions of Gays in Hollywood, which runs through September 2015, and even show us a few special museum pieces to whet our appetites for a real visit. Danelle Dadigan, welcome to Mr. Media.
Well, hi, Bob. I got to tell you, I know why they call you Mr. Media. That was a fabulous intro, and I think if it's okay, I'd love to use it every time. That is great. Thank you so much for speaking so highly of the Hollywood Museum.
Sir, just take me wherever you go in the future. It'll be fine.
Fabulous.
I get 32 cents a mile. We'll just work it out.
Okay.
All right. Well, let's start with where you are. I know this is a very special room at the museum, so before we do anything else, tell me about where you're sitting.
Well, you know, the exciting thing about the Hollywood Museum is that we are located in the historic Max Factor building. It's where Max Factor, Hollywood's makeup king during Hollywood's golden era, made all the movie stars look fabulous. You know, they walked in looking like you and me, and walked out looking like silver screen gods and goddesses. And you did it in these makeup rooms. And today I am sitting in the brownettes only room. And I don't know if any of your viewers know what brownette is. I certainly didn't. But a brownette, according to Max Factor, is anyone who has hair lighter than mine, but still brown. And Max Factor believed about 80% of brunettes really were brownettes. This is the very room where Max Factor saw all of his movie stars from the golden era, whether it was Judy Garland, Angela Lansbury, Rita Hayworth, Joan Crawford, Katharine Hepburn, Betty Davis. He saw them all here. And he wanted to improve their looks. And it's in this very room where he decided to maybe lighten their hair a little bit, darken a little bit, give it some highlights, even change the shape of their hairline, which he did on Rita Hayworth. And then she appeared in that fabulous film, Gilda, which just, as you know, just set her on the course to superstardom. But today, this is the very room we're in where Max Factor met all of his movie star clients for the first time.
And can you fill some of us in who might not have as much history on Max Factor? Tell us a little about the museum, but also its connection to Max Factor and where you fit into all of this.
Well, I don't know if I should start off with or end with, but let me just start off with, I'm the crazy who fits in the middle of all of this, frankly. And it was a real passion for my mom and myself to be able to give something back to the community. And my mom and I both being school teachers, and there's probably a joke here somewhere because my dad was a school teacher too. We knew that one of the most important gifts we could give anyone or pass on was education and an interest and desire to learn more. Because that is the future of all cultures, is continuation and learning. And so we thought, well, gee, what does Los Angeles have? What does Hollywood have? What's the most important export? Well, for us, it was very simple. It was Hollywood, the entertainment industry. And we realized there really was no museum that told the whole story about Hollywood. And from its humble beginnings through today, have legends in the making, legends that have been made, and future legends. So as we were hunting high and low, we came across the Max Factor building. Of course, the kicker is that it was not for sale. Of course, because as you know, all things that you want are not easily attainable. So it set us on a course of about 2+ years trying to talk the owners of Max Factor Cosmetics Company, Procter & Gamble, into selling this beloved building. So since 1928, as we just discussed, Max Factor, who bought the building in 1928, it continued to be part of the Max Factor Cosmetics Company until we came along in the mid-80s and purchased this building from Procter & Gamble. But so enamored were my mom and myself with the connection to Max Factor that we also purchased the name and the title that went along with the building, Max Factor Building, Max Factor Makeup Studio, and on and on and on. Because the history of Max Factor is so integral not only to this building, but to Hollywood, the history of Hollywood. I mean, this is where all the movie stars got their looks. You know, once upon a time, when they walked in, as we talked about before, looking like us, you know, it wasn't that these folks were any better looking in the 20s and 30s than they were today. But it was Max Factor's genius that turned them into those superstars and glamorous individuals that we saw up on the big screen in front of us in the darkened theaters. And I have to appreciate that because today, you know, we snap our fingers and we get, you know, liposuction and plastic surgery at a drop of a hat. In the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s, 60s, not so. And so Max Factor was able to create it on the spot with his makeup genius, his shading, and his lighting. And that's what made all the difference in the world. So today we're sitting in the Brownettes Only Room, and it's fun because you can take a look at how the concept work was. You know, we all go to the department store and we want to look at something, and the salesperson comes to us and says, let me do your colors, or do you know what color you look best in? Well, that all started with Max Factor in the early 1930s, and it was because of the invention of Hollywood's three-strip Technicolor film process. Max Factor being the professional makeup artist that he was and Hollywood's makeup king at the time, he realized he could no longer fake that look going from shades of very dark to light with lots of shades of gray in between. And it kind of simulated dark hair, medium complexion, light complexion. You know, now he had to be absolutely accurate because of color, and not just any color. It was that extremely expensive and accurate an unforgiving true color made with a three-step process, with three films going through the camera at the same time to bring out the reds, the yellows, and the blues even more so. So it's in this room that Max Factor met most of his stars for the first time.
And Danelle, was the building empty when you acquired it? I mean, was it being used? Was it empty? And What do you have now that was still with the building?
Oh, hey, great question, Bob. I really appreciate you asking that, because when we purchased the building, we came in and the Max Factor Museum of Beauty was still operating, and it closed when we started our restoration. So all the historic makeup rooms and the lobby and different areas in the building were still being used and still being shown to the public as a museum. But we decided that we would want to restore this building, not to be a commercial version of what Max Factor sort of kind of was. We wanted to be accurate. And so we procured a set of plans dated 1934, and we restored this building to look exactly the way it looked when Max Factor first opened his doors.
And how big is the building itself, like square footage or floors? How can you quantify it?
Well, the building has five floors, and each floor is about 7,000 square feet. I'm going to drink some water.
Sure. Well, for people who are doing the math, I don't know how much of that is visible to the public. 7,000 times five floors, 35,000 square foot. That's about the size of an average Sports Authority store or the Office Depot, something like that. So that's a lot of space. And how much of that is in use for exhibits and visible to the public at this point?
Excuse me. About 33,000 square feet.
That's a lot.
Yes.
That's a lot. And so what, you know, I'm sure it's always very cool to be in the Hollywood Museum, but what makes one day more special than another? Is it the arrival of a new exhibit or what gets you excited there after having done this for so long?
You know, every day is like a treasure hunt. Every day is a treasure hunt when I come to the museum, whether it's that way before I start my day, during my day, meeting other collectors, movie stars, television stars, past and present, their families, and meeting with studio execs and production companies. You never know what you're going to hear. You never know what you're going to learn. You're never going to know what you're going to see.
When did the museum actually open?
Well, we opened in 2003, okay, by appointment only. And that went on for about a year and a half or so. Then we opened 2 days, 3 days. And now we're open 5 days a week with no appointment, Wednesday through Sunday, 10 to 5 p.m. Right.
And is the museum for-profit or not-for-profit?
Well, that's probably why I'm choking, because the museum is a nonprofit. And as you know, most museums, they cannot operate on admission only. And so, but we have yet to fundraise, and we will be doing that soon. And we really felt that, contrary to the concept of lots of PR, lots of hype, and not too much substance, you can put your substance in later, we chose the reverse road. Because this is truly a passion for me, and when my mom was living, for both of us, it was something we did together. We dedicated our lives to filling this museum, to acquiring memorabilia to be able to share with the public. Because people from all over the world, you know, the one word everyone knows, no matter where they live, what their culture is, what their language is, there's one word they all know. And I don't even have to say it, because you know it, and your audience knows it too. But I will say it, it's Hollywood. And so we realize that everyone is clamoring to learn about Hollywood's past, their very humble beginnings, and how it became such a word today, and such it evokes such emotions and such state of mind, much more so than the actual state of being. But we want for people when they come to Hollywood and Hollywood Boulevard to be able to have a place to come to see the 100-plus years of Hollywood and how it became.
The idea is to give people an actual Hollywood experience.
Oh, I think so. You know, whether it's walking down the jail cell corridor of Hannibal Lecter, where you saw the jail cell corridor, the exact same area that Jodie Foster walked, as Dr. Clarice Starling, and sitting in her chair, looking into Anthony Hopkins, Dr. Lecter's jail cell, seeing all the artwork he drew during his incarceration on the walls, his jail cell uniform jumpsuit, even his tennis shoes, his straitjacket, the books he read, the pass-through, even, you know, the sink in the toilet with all the hygiene products that were there. Everything is original, original, original. And we have a lot of fun allowing our public to sort of interact with this. It's the closest they're ever going to get. And to think that they're walking in a real scent, because this scent was removed from the soundstage at Universal and with complete with the original set of plans, remodeled and put back in place here at the Hollywood Museum in our lower level. And by the way, the lower level during Prohibition days was used as a bowling alley and a speakeasy.
Oh.
I kind of wonder if Max Factor on a slow week or month, you know, subsidized his profits with what he made in the lower level in the speakeasy. And his brother, Jake the Barber, the black sheep of the family, he made the bootleg moonshine liquor. He made it next door where Miles Drive-In is today, and they brought it through the back entrance.
I would wonder myself if maybe Max Factor ran the speakeasy because at the end of a long day of dealing with certain Hollywood stars, he needed a good stiff drink or two or three.
Well, you never know. But, you know, he was so professional. And that's a great, great comment. But that leads me to tell you that next door, still in the Max Factor building where we now have Mel's Drive-In, it was where the lesser makeup salon and studio was and where the beauty salon was, where the women had their hair washed and dyed to the great colors that the directors and writers and producers chose for the movie star's character that they portrayed. In the back area there, there was actually a special room that we discovered when we came here, and there were catwalks up above the ceiling with holes in the ceiling, and I believe it was either to make sure that the card games were legitimate downstairs, you know, in the main area, or actually to help maybe the house cheat a little bit. Not sure which one.
No, I'm sure it wasn't that.
I don't think so either. No. Of course not.
Could not have been that. All right, so you've got with you there some actual artifacts from the museum to kind of tease us a little bit about what's available. You tell me, what do you want to start with?
Well, you know, I think it's kind of fun to talk about from our LGBT exhibit this summer. It's the second annual one, and we do this in partnership with our city councilman, Mitchell Farrell, and we're in Council District 13 in Los Angeles, even though we are Hollywood. And that is Jeffrey Tambor's costume when he plays Mara Pfefferman. And this is fun because this is from the TV show Transparent from Amazon. And it's great on several different levels because Amazon is relatively a newcomer to television and to mainstream audiences. And Jeffrey Tambor is a very established actor who has now returned to television. And he is playing a groundbreaking role as a transgender. And this is extraordinary because as you can see, and we'll move the camera for you to see, that this costume that Jeffrey Tambor wore, by the way, this is the iconic costume from the TV show. It's the color of the LGBTQ rainbow. And it is in his costume. And, of course, it is a woman's dress. So that's kind of a fun thing, complete with the necklace. And you can't watch Transparent, a trailer of it, without seeing this costume in it.
Very nice. And so tell me, while we're talking about the exhibit, tell me a little bit more about what people would find in the exhibit if they can come to the museum in person, in the reel-to-reel exhibit?
Well, that's great because, you know, we actually spent about 100 years. We actually even show the first film, Silent That It Was, in the late 1800s, showing two men dancing together. And it's a very short snippet, but nonetheless, it shows that this was depicted. And we go all the way through from the silent area, you know, Rudolph Valentino, all the way through the golden era of Hollywood when the movie studios and the execs were not necessarily in favor of exposing private lifestyles or lifestyles in your private life. And so as a result, there still was this closeted effect and closeted workplace. And what we can appreciate is that there were many stars who had to live by this code, but in their private lives, they were different. We don't necessarily delve into that too much, but what we do is be able to talk about the different characters and plot lines of LGBT. And so for us, like Two and a Half Men, I mean, this is a fabulous show, very current. And this year, the daughter, you know, of Charlie Sheen comes back, who we have not seen before, and she is a lesbian. And so we go through the trials and tribulations of her trying to find a mate, and all done with comedy and all done relatively tastefully, but so that a young audience can enjoy it. So it's fun to see that, you know, whether it's the icons of Elizabeth Taylor, you know, here she was the first ambassador to AMFAR, and she dedicated really the last years of her life to helping to find a cure for AIDS and also to build tolerance and to build that bridge that had come from somewhere, but nobody really knows how, but to stop that bridge and just make it one continuous ground and one continuous road that everyone walked on. And I have to tell you, I had the wonderful opportunity of meeting Miss Taylor before she passed away. She actually came to the museum, and we received from her as a gift the hat she wore in National Velvet, as well as one of the costumes from one of her last TV films. So it was a lot of fun. We really enjoyed it, and it was a great conversation to have with her. And by that time in her life, she had time to slow down just a moment to ask a few questions.
Hmm. All right. That's a great explanation for the exhibit. Now, what's next on your what are you going to show and tell?
So a little bit more about the LGBT exhibit. What's fun is that we also have, you know, Days of Our Lives, Bold and Beautiful. We've got Portlandia. We've got Orphan Black, Ray Donovan. I mean, you know, it's even the cult movies, Sordid Lives. We've got Al Pacino's jacket that he wore in Cruising from the 1980s. You know, what exhibit wouldn't be complete without a Bruce Valanche or, you know, Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie. It's always fun. And, you know, we even got the wonderful formal gown from Sharon Stone, who's now the current ambassador for AMFAR. We have the dress that Jennifer Lopez wore when she received her GLAAD award. And it goes on and on, you know, whether and we also have icons. And those icons are individuals that male, female, they may be gay, they may not be, they may be in, they may be out of the closet, but they resonate very well with the LGBTQ community, and they are very much in demand from this community. So that's always kind of fun for us. So that would also include, you know, whether it's Joel Grace Kane from Chicago, whether it's Barbara Stanwyck's fabulous beaded gown she wore to the Academy Awards, Judy Garland, Joan Crawford, Betty Davis, Dinah Shore, Lily Tomlin, and her partner, Jane Wagner. We not only have their plaque from the Walk of Fame in Palm Springs they received together, but we also have Lily's chair that she sat in when she played the character Edith Ann from Laugh-It in the late 1960s. And the list just goes on, and it spans about 90 years of entertainment. So much fun for us, and we encourage everyone to come and see it. No matter what the reason is for you to come and visit it, you will be entertained, and that's what's exciting. There's something for everyone of every era, of every decade, and of every liking.
Okay. And what do you want to show us next?
Oh, I'm being handed. I'm being handed. I don't know if you can see this or not, but maybe I should hold it up. These are items, these are actually fabulous pieces of jewelry that were from Marilyn Monroe's. And what's fun about this was that these items were auctioned off at a charity auction, and they were from Marilyn Monroe's estate many, many years ago. What's fun about this era of Marilyn Monroe is to be able to say that most of these celebrities, probably other than their major pieces of jewelry, whether either wedding band or beautiful earring, whatnot, most of it was paste or costume because it was the popular thing to do. And so these artifacts, of course, are not real diamonds, but they are paste. They are simulated to look like that. And you know, when you film them, it's quite something to see that. This one is a real fun one because this one is one of the first pieces of jewelry, in quotes, that Marilyn bought for her with one of her first paychecks. It's old. It's from the 40s. And she must have loved it so much that she kept it. We have quite a few photos with her wearing this in her early years.
Nice. Very nice. All right.
But you know, what is also fun about Marilyn that I love to show is this photograph here. And I'm going to put it in front of me for just a moment. Can you see it?
Yeah, it's we can sort of make it out. A lot of people and someone circled over there to the right. I assume that's Marilyn?
Yes, it is Marilyn. And this is her junior high school class photo.
Oh, wow.
If you can believe it. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
And so what's fun about this photo is the girl that circled does not have blonde hair. She has brown hair because Marilyn's natural blonde hair, like most natural blondes, turned by the time she became a teenager. And so everyone says to me, oh, Danelle, how did you get that photo? And I love to share the story. One of my mom's dearest friends went to Ralph Waldo Emerson Junior High and is sitting in the front row of this class photo. And she always saved it because she knew Norma Jean, because in those days she was Norma Jean Mortensen. Uh-huh. And so she saved it and she told me, she said, Danelle, I have something for you. When you open this museum, I have something that you will just love. And it's this very photo. And because of this, this is one of the proving shots that we have besides Marilyn Monroe's first wedding photograph from her first marriage to Jim Doherty when she was 16 years old. She married the boy next door because she could not continue to live with her foster families because they were moving to the East Coast. And so it was either going back into the institutional lifestyle or seeing if she could get married. And her foster mother and the mother of Jim Doherty were friends and they made that arrangement. And so Marilyn's first wedding photo has her with brown hair. And it was Max Factor in this very building in the blondes only room that we would have sat in, except I have to be honest, with that blue surrounding, I didn't look so good as a natural brunette. So I came in a room that I thought I'd look a lot better in, which is the brownettes only room. But Marilyn was made a blonde in the blondes only room about 15 feet away from us here in the museum.
Very cool.
Now, it's funny because this summer we have got a great exhibit on Marilyn Monroe, and it's probably the largest authentic Marilyn Monroe museum in the world. And we're thrilled because we have, you know, over 15 costumes plus personal clothing plus items from her childhood all the way through, you know, her three marriages, through all the films that she did, radio shows, television, including the furniture that she put in her last home. And you know that furniture she actually handpicked from Mexico, if you can believe it or not. And it was trucked in here to Los Angeles, and some of it, most of it, got into her home before she passed away in August of 1962.
Now, you've got one more thing to show us, I think. This is a very special Max Factor item, right?
Oh, yes, it is. Well, this is one of a kind, and this is quite fabulous. This is what Max Factor invented in the early 1930s, and it is called the Beauty Calibrator. And what's really interesting about this was that Max Factor regarded makeup, the application of it, as a science. And like we talked about before, because there was no such thing as fast plastic surgery or liposuction, or, you know, working to change the shape of your eyes, et cetera, he did that all through shading and all through makeup. And that's kind of a fun thing, because this actually measured each of the characteristics and features on the celebrity's face. He then knew if your eyebrows were too far apart, too short, if your nose was too long, too short, the bridge of your nose too wide, your nostrils not the right shape, your lips too thin, too thick, too wide, too narrow. I can go down the list. You know, you don't have high cheekbones, but you should have them, or you have too much jowls or not enough predominant chin line or jawline, your forehead was too high, too low. I mean, I can go down the list. It was a science for him. And by taking those measurements, he then recreated on your face what he thought the epitome of perfect, pristine looks would be. And he did that again, just using his makeup and shading and lighting. So if you were to see some of Max Factor's most beautiful women that he made up, including very fancy, if you saw it with the naked eye, you would see all of a sudden there would be blotches of war paint here, maybe war paint here, maybe bright patch up here. That was so to feature and lift the forehead and make it higher, maybe. Here it was to narrow down the jowls. Here it was to give you the effect that the bridge of your nose was narrower and your nose more refined. He was quite something else. I even know how to change the shape of your eyelid. And it's all because of this beautifully one, and Max Factor was the one that used it.
Very nice. All right. Well, before we wrap up, I got one more important one or two important questions for you. I'm wondering what item would be kind of the Hope Diamond of the Hollywood Museum? The one thing, you know, like when you go to the Louvre, you've got to see David, things like that. You've got to see Mona Lisa. What is the one thing when you go to the Hollywood Museum that everyone must see?
Well, you know, Bob, that's a hard one to answer. And as president and founder of the Hollywood Museum, I really shouldn't have a favorite. But what I will tell you is that the museum tells four stories. Hollywood entertainment industry, Max Factor's Hollywood connection, the fabulous Art Deco Regency style architecture of this building, which, by the way, we won a State of California Preservation Award many years ago, as well as a historic photographic element of how Hollywood, the community, grew because of this entertainment industry. But if I was to like kind of try to figure this out, of course it's Marilyn Monroe. We have the ultimate Marilyn Monroe exhibit at all times at the museum. We even have Cary Grant's Rolls Royce. We have Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, her Thunderbird, the Macabre Mobile. By the way, the interior is done in leopard skin lining, and the truck looks like the inside of a coffin. Besides that, you know, there is the scariest lower level, the one where it used to be the speakeasy and bowling alley during Prohibition days. It's where we house Hannibal Lecter's jail cell and all things creepy down there. I think what I would say is there's something for everyone.
And how much time should someone allow to see the museum properly if they're scheduling their time as a tourist?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, because sometimes when we do special events here, you know, we have a top floor, an upper room, it's a ballroom, completely open from the front to the back of the building. It's huge. And it's got, you know, we do dinners, we do seminars, we do award shows, we do screenings, we do panels. We do quite a bit up there. And in fact, that's where Max Factor used to mix his powder products when he had his factory here and blow that scent out on Hollywood Boulevard. So all the innocent women in the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s that were walking on the boulevard during Hollywood Boulevard's heyday would innocently smell Max Factor fragrance and beckon them to the building to buy some. But I would say that, you know, some people do this museum, I don't know how, but they do it in 45 minutes. Some people, you know, they spend an entire day here. They get their hands stamped, go off to lunch, and come back and spend the balance of the day, because we even have a screening room where we do show different films.
All right. Well, folks, listen, you can visit the Hollywood Museum in person Wednesdays through Sundays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. It's located at 1660 North Highland Avenue at Hollywood Boulevard in, of course, Hollywood, California. The website is thehollywoodmuseum.com. I'm guessing that the museum has a presence on Facebook and Twitter probably and other social media.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, it's fascinating. I love that you've been able to give us kind of a peek inside and tell us some special stories. Hopefully we'll have a lot of people wanting to get over there and see it in person, see everything you've got. And Danelle Dadigan, I just want to thank you very much for being a guest today on Mr. Media.
Well, thank you so much, Bob. We really enjoyed it. In fact, I loved it. Thank you again.
Hi, this is Buzz Burbank in the Buzz Burbank Newsroom, preparing for you another Buzz Burbank news and comment. Do you like good stories? Boy, I sure do. I turn over a lot of stones each day to make sure I don't miss the best ones. Sure, some make me angry, and some make me sad, and some make me laugh, and isn't that what makes us human? I'm proud of the fact that I pack more news into my 10 or 15 minutes a day than the evening news does in a half hour. It's a free podcast at BuzzBurbank.com, or you can subscribe free at iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or get it on any RSS device. It's like a newspaper for your head. It's Buzz Burbank News and Comment, another Realm Network presentation. Weekday mornings right here on the Realm Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the George and Tony Entertainment Show. Prepare for awesome mediocrity.
We're the Cousin Oliver of the Realm Network. I'm George.
And I'm Tony.
And we're a weekly family-friendly podcast about pop culture.
From our point of view.
At RealmNetwork.com. The George and Tony Entertainment Show. From the Realm Network.
This is Snake. Do you read me, Otacon?
Loud and clear, Snake.
Did you listen to the latest episode of the Gaming Marathon on the Realm Network?
Of course. They really know their stuff about gaming, especially that Usid guy.
Yeah, but that Chirac guy is a real jerk. I don't like him.
Regardless, the reviews are spot on and they tell it like it is.
That's for sure.
What happened, Snake? Were you spotted?
Nah, it's just Lowell Melser crying about the O's again.
Close call.
I better continue the search for Metal Gear, but keep listening to the Gaming Marathon each week.
You got it, Snake.
New every Monday afternoon right here on the Realm Network.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said that they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
What you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
These are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot. Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
Resistance is futile. It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights.